Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Protests calling for police reforms and an end to systemic racism have filled city streets in Columbus and across the country for nearly a month. Social media-enabled demonstrations to organize thousands in a matter of hours, a feat that took months to accomplish in the civil rights era. But rapid mobilization also means that protesters sacrifice structure, go without the prominent leadership and clout of the likes of Martin Luther King Jr. and Malcolm X. Coming up, we're going to hear from a cross-section of those groups with a foothold in the current demonstrations. Ashley Howard is an associate professor of history at the University of Iowa. Her research includes the history of blacks in the Midwest, social movements, and the global history of racial violence. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
You know, it took a decade to organize the 1963 March on Washington. I've done interviews with people who have written entire books on just that topic. How does it matter that we can do it and that people can do it in a matter of hours now because of social media?
Well, I mean, I think it expands the people who get to participate and the places that we see these demonstrations. One of the things that I find to be most remarkable about the protests that we've seen of late is how multiracial they are. So you don't need to be tapped into some of these anti-racist or other Black organizations like you may have during the Civil Rights era. If you are a concerned person, if you want to be a part of it, all you have to do is follow the right people on Twitter and have that information. Similarly, this is in small towns. Over 700 cities throughout the country have experienced these types of protests. And so people have the capacity now to organize in tiny towns throughout the U.S. And I think that's a really tremendous way in making this a national movement more than we've seen before.
How did the power structure within the old civil rights movements provide that level of political influence, or was it the sheer numbers?
Well, I think there's oftentimes kind of a myth making of these things. I think about the Montgomery bus boycott in 1955. And so although activists like Rosa Parks, you know, she was a train organizer, she went to the Highlander Folk School, although people like that had been learning how to mobilize protesters for some time, that actual movement really came about overnight. Joanne Robinson, who was a professor at a local Black college, she went to her office and mimeoed, you know, using that old technology, mimeoed flyers to distribute. And so the Women's Political Caucus was an organization, but they really made that boycott, which lasted a year, happen over the course of a weekend. So it's that ability to make it happen. It's just that we forget that it can happen.
I'm glad you raised the role of women, which is often overlooked in the civil rights movement history books. Women were the backbone, but you very rarely hear their names.
Absolutely. And, you know, we see this not only in the civil rights movement, but truly in every major rights movement we've seen in the United States. Women are doing that labor, and they are doing the labor that makes movement work. Oftentimes, we see men come to the forefront, oftentimes after the labor has done, to be the spokesperson. But the folks who are organizing, the folks that are making sure there are food at meetings and chairs and getting people out, women are doing that labor because they're building those connections. And it's oftentimes that men kind of swoop in and take the leadership role, as we saw with the Southern Christian Leadership Conference with the 1955 Montgomery bus boycott.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking today about the protests, the protesters, the demonstrations, who organizes them, how they're organized today, and what the rapid mobilization that is enabled by social media means and how it matters. First, we're looking back and we're considering the historical context of this with Ashley Howard. She's an associate professor of history at the University of Iowa. Her research includes the history of blacks in the Midwest, social movements, and the global history of racial violence. If you have a question or comment this hour coming up, we're going to have lots of representatives from different organizations joining us, and you're certainly welcome to join the conversation, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You mentioned the Southern Christian...
Southern Christian Leadership
Thank
Conference.
Thank you. Southern Christian Leadership Conference, which raises another question, and that's churches. They were a huge force in the 1960s civil rights movement. We still turn to faith leaders. I know that city officials turn to faith leaders. Whenever there's an issue about policing, faith leaders tend to be involved. There's certainly, you know, been on this show plenty of times. Are they at the forefront that they once were? How do they play a role going forward today, do you think?
I think this is kind of this moment of complexity that we see happening. And it really began with the Black Lives Matter movement. And you saw a lot of kind of finger shaking, finger wagging, saying this isn't how we organize, because BLM activists really invested in what they called a leaderful movement, meaning there's not a central leader, but rather there are many people organizing to do what they can do best in the spheres that they are in. And so I very much see the protests happening now, a continuation of that. Queer activist groups, mm-hmm. Black groups, immigrant groups, these are all the people who have been organizing for years that are really leading the charge going forth. And so I think whereas oftentimes municipal leaders, state leaders are going to go to church officials because they have long been seen as the, quote, voice of the community, it's really grassroots leadership that are driving it and are going to bring about the most revolutionary changes.
Right, the grassroots. And how do they bring about revolutionary change? How, when it's grassroots, is there a natural progression here that just hasn't started?
Well, I mean, I think we really see this with a lot of the street protests that occurred in the 1960s, right? Uprisings were tremendously successful in the kind of first instances that they occurred in cities. Mm-hmm. I researched Omaha, Nebraska, and the NAACP had been asking for years to have an unemployment office put in the Black neighborhood, and the state deferred. And then after a single weekend of an uprising, they received, from Friday to Sunday, on Tuesday, an unemployment office was put on North 24th Street. And so people were talking and grieving, right? And in every uprising, you know, Cincinnati, Ohio, for example, the people who are participating are going to city council and say, this is what we want. This is what it should look like. So there is that dialogue happening between folks who don't necessarily have official leadership positions, but are accurately reflecting what the community needs.
I wanted to talk about the diversity piece a little bit again. There's diversity. It's being observed repeatedly. What the role do whites play in affecting change through this movement?
Well, sure. And again, this is what I think is just so really powerful about this moment. People can speak in the communities where their voice is more effectively heard, right? I have college students that I lecture to and engage with reading. That's my audience. And I think white people have a particular place and, frankly, responsibility to talk in their communities, talk with their friends, their relatives, those people who may not hear it from a Black woman saying, this is my experience, but may listen more keenly if a white person says that, and really think about the privilege that they have and what it means to put that privilege on the line, right? And so I've been using this phrase, which Indigenous activists have been saying, is we don't need allies, we need co-conspirators. We need people willing to struggle and that their own comfort and their own safety, in a sense, may be at risk. And we've seen that firsthand with tear gas and rubber bullets, but also might you lose friendship? Might your neighbors give you a stink eye if you put Black Lives Matter sign in your yard? Uh-huh. These things that are uncomfortable and really interrogating your own privilege and the own ways that you may be contributing to these problems as well.
The observation that the current movement lacks hierarchical leadership, even, you know, in Columbus, and I'm sure everywhere, there's divergence. There are different points of view. There are different levels of change being sought, dismantling police departments, defunding police departments, reforming police departments or transforming them or whatever iteration it might take in any individual's mind. What is your sense about how success is measured when there's so much divergence?
Well, you know, even with the 1963 March on Washington, there was a great deal of divergence there. You know, King wanted his I Have a Dream speech was very much a moment of racial reconciliation and forward thinking. Whereas John Lewis's original speech indicted America and really called them out on the racist practices. And so even in these moments, you know, there's this tension. For me, and I think for many other folks, this moment for liberal reform has failed, right? We have tried to elect officials in a capacity, you know, Barack Obama, Eric Holder, Black people in high places. We have tried police reforms. We have tried to have accountability measures, and all of these things have fallen short. And I think that's really where the conversation is shifting. Our people are really trying to identify what the problem is, what their concerns are, and then look for solutions that do that. And I think ultimately what we're going to see are people begin to imagine radical possibilities beyond just having, you know, a police review board or having some of these kind of stopgap measures to really begin to unpack the harm that's been done in many communities.
What do you think does history teach us about what it will take to have this moment in time endure, have the longevity it needs to achieve goals?
That's a great question. I think what history teaches us is that movements are made not in these, you know, newsworthy Pulitzer Prize winning photographed moments, right? Mm-hmm. That struggle comes with the mundane, in the boring everyday of organizing and sending out emails and making sure people who are protesting have water and coming together to draft a document or grievances, and just the day-to-day of constantly organizing, constantly keeping focus, and constantly keeping people and resources mobilized to bring about this change. You know, the Montgomery bus boycott, kind of this iconic moment, a lot of people think it was just a flash in the pan. It lasted for over a year, mm-hmm. a bus boycott of a major city. So they had to, mostly women, coordinate taxi rides, ride shares, made sure that people could get to their jobs, make sure people knew alternatives to riding the bus. And so it's that movement building. It's that bringing together people and ideas and sharing everything that we have to sustain this drive.
What role do you think the pandemic's played in the time and circumstance of these demonstrations?
I think it's played a tremendous role. I think, first of all, we know that COVID-19 disproportionately affects Black and Latinx communities. Mm-hmm. And so this narrative of race-based disparities was already kind of in the foreground of our minds. So I think that plays a huge role. And I think it's turned our world upside down, and that has given us a space to dream and to think differently. You know, why is it that our health insurance is tied to our employment? Why is it that the state, you know, in times of crisis can give us, you know, a sum of money, but may not want to give, you know, a $15 minimum wage? And so it's helping us understand kind of the shared struggle that we're going into and the role that we can play in asking for and the government can play in providing. And I think all of these factors really align to have people begin to think about this moment in a new liberatory way.
Ashley Howard, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
It was wonderful. Thank you so much for having me.
Ashley Howard is an associate professor of history at the University of Iowa, where her research includes the history of Blacks in the Midwest, social movements, and the global history of racial violence. Coming up, we're going to hear from representatives of different groups that you're watching downtown demonstrate over the past 3 or 4 weeks. If you have a question or comment, want to join the conversation about how this movement is different, or why it's not different, or where it might be headed, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Thank you.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Social media enables protest organizers to amass thousands of participants in a matter of hours rather than the months and sometimes years civil rights era organizers would have needed. The advantage of such speed is obvious, but it costs too. The movement lacks hierarchy and focus and political clout, and it's unclear who speaks for the protesters and with whom some protesters will speak. We have invited what we hope is a good cross-section of groups engaged in the Central Ohio demonstrations that, as across the rest of the country, erupted after the police killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis on Memorial Day. Also in the wake of the vigilante-style killing in February of Ahmaud Arbery in Georgia and the March death of Breonna Taylor, who was fatally shot by Louisville Metro police officers executing a no-knock search warrant. Jasmine Ayers is a community organizer for People's Justice Project, the founder of which serves on the newly formed Chief's Advisory Panel in the Division of Police for the City of Columbus. Jasmine, welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Mia Santiago is a founding member of the Columbus Freedom Coalition, one of a number of local groups protesting police violence. The group wants to abolish the police department and prisons and has called for the resignations of the mayor and the police chief in Columbus. Welcome, Mia Santiago.
Good morning.
Ambrose Dupree is a core organizer of Black Queer and Intersectional Collective, or BQIC. Welcome to the show, Ambrose.
Hi. Thanks so much.
Jasmine, let's start with you. What has it taken? What have you seen about how they've organized the demonstrations, the likes of which we've seen in Columbus?
Absolutely. So what we've seen has been absolutely amazing. And while I think social media has allowed us to do more rapid response stuff, the first few weeks of protesters that was just organic. Like people just knew that if I show up at the state house at 11 a.m., people that have similar values to me and that are fighting for Black lives are going to be there. And so I think like that is some of what has been so powerful and so amazing. And honestly, as an organizer, not having to organize every single march or protest or event, is wonderful. It is a lot of time and a lot of energy, and to see new people stepping up has really been fantastic.
What do you think, Mia Santiago?
I've been really excited to see kind of just the massive and very diverse group of protesters who've been showing up. I think there's a lot of people where it might be their first protest, and so it's really cool to watch people become radicalized and figure out what they believe in real time.
And, you know, Ambrose, it's not just the color of the skin. It's all different age groups. It's people from all different places showing up downtown from what I see, and a lot of joy there, too. What do you think about how it's been organized or maybe lack of organization, just that kind of organic response that Jasmine was talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. There's nothing to be it's exciting, all the power and all the energy around it, and where people are coming from. People are coming from different parts of the state to come down to be part of this movement. And that's exciting because there's just more people who are, as Neil was saying, this might be their first protest, and this is how they're going to get involved. And they're really seeing how their city is working in real time and how we can affect change and really make something happen.
One of the last questions I asked the history professor from the University of Iowa was the endurance piece of all of this. Jasmine Ayers, what's your sense about, you know, you mentioned, and I think makes perfect sense, that it's not all on the backs of just a few people, that a lot of people are getting involved and continuing to get involved. But endurance-wise, what's your sense about how far this can go?
This moment feels different. And what gives me extra hope is when Angela Davis says this moment feels different.
I guess she should know, huh?
Right. And I'm actually have sort of a list of demands that we delivered to the city in 2016 that called for 50% of the budget to be reallocated to prevention and intervention and community control policing. So there are people and groups who have been doing this for years. And what I really see is Columbus taking its next step as an organizing city, as an activist city, as a protest city. And so I think folks are in this for the long haul. I think we have, everybody is paying attention. Every sector, every type of person is paying attention. And I think when you have something that is that universal, it has to move forward. And really good conversations are happening. And so I'm encouraged. I'm very encouraged by this moment.
What do you think, Mia Santiago, about the durability of the movement at this point?
I think that we have kind of a great base that's joining, and it's the job of groups that have already been here for a while and are established and know what they're fighting for when they say abolition, to kind of create structure for people to join and make sure that they can be involved in a way that's lasting and not necessarily just direct action, like showing up at the state house, but also through political education and kind of community engagement to make sure that this is a not just long-lasting but permanent state for the United States.
And what you're saying is, when it comes to when you're saying calling for abolition, make sure everybody's got the same definition.
Yes.
That you're all talking in the same, with the same lexicon.
Yes, because there's some confusion, I think, maybe among other groups about what abolishing the police means, and it's more than just defunding. That's one step towards it, which is why I encourage people to join organizations that have been around for a little bit.
You know, Mia, some people that are demonstrating are for defunding and abolishing the police, and some aren't for defunding and abolishing the police. Are you comfortable with everybody being together asking for change in general, even though you may differ on the details?
That's a tricky question, because on some level, it's important that everyone be engaged, and we want everyone who's on our side to show up. But where I think it is most important is when decisions are being made, when demands are being released, and we cannot compromise on abolition, because then we're going to end up with the same reforms that we've had for decades, for generations that have done nothing. So once it gets to that point, I think we have to be kind of clear that abolition means abolishing police. It means abolishing prisons. It does not mean reform.
Ambrose Dupree, what do you think about that, the durability and also the diversity, not just in color, but in, you know, thought of what should come from all of this?
Yeah, I was listening to the previous speaker and talking about how being able to speak to your certain community and using your kind of your power, who you have an audience to. I mean, there's so much raw energy right now, and now is the point to really mobilize and organize. And it's exactly what you would say. We have to trust the people who've been doing this for a long time. With PJP, that's 2016, and we've been saying these things for a long time. But now that everybody's listening, it's turning those ears and turning into action.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. And still with us is Ambrose Dupree. He is a core organizer of Black Queer and Intersectional Collective, although it's called Be Quick for short. Jasmine Ayers is a community organizer for People's Justice Project and a policy liaison for Policy Matters Ohio. She's on by Skype. And Mia Santiago is a founding member of the Columbus Freedom Coalition, one of a number of local groups protesting police violence and asking for abolition of the police department and defunding the police department. Mia, I wanted to talk about, you wrote an article in Gen Magazine on Wednesday that said that the decentralized structure of the protests is why they're working. And I wanted you to talk about why is that, that the decentralization helps them work, and also address concerns by people that feel like it's too fractionalized and that that's going to create problems going forward as far as who speaks for whom.
Well, when I say decentralized, I guess I'm pointing kind of to the organic nature that other speakers have mentioned too, of the protests. And I think it's important that people feel that they can be directly involved and that they know that they can enact change just by showing up, regardless of whether or not they're affiliated with a group. And I think it does go back to the point made of groups can't organize every protest every time. I do think that it's important that leadership steps up from groups that have been established and know the community, so that we don't end up, you know, following behind someone who maybe is confused or misguided on the policy that they're asking for. So I think it's exciting to have a more decentralized movement, so it doesn't fall all on the shoulders of a few organizers or mm-hmm. a few groups to kind of organize an entire city. But I think it's also important that the groups that do exist do their part to make sure that this is shaped in the right way.
Jasmine, it takes funding. I'm trying to think of a generic word. It takes right. money. And, you know, coming from as a policy liaison for Policy Matters Ohio, you know that. I mean, someone's printing up something. Someone's putting it out there. As you go forward, do you see that becoming an issue? Is fundraising going on that is useful and going to be productive going forward?
Yeah, so in this moment, people want to help and people are feeling generous. So my concern is not really what's going to happen over the next few months. It is, right? So if I have a friend that works for a company that has a giant printer and they're willing to print 2,000 flyers for me, that's fantastic. Mm-hmm. But in a year, what I really need is for that company to, you know, like fund a community liaison position at their office. And so I think there's sort of a lens of what do we need short term? And I think short term, there are a lot of resources out there. But long term, like people need to understand that this is a long term commitment and not all the answers are visible right now because things are still sort of playing out on the ground. And I did just sort of want to address the sort of like nebulous nature of what's going on. People see what happens on the streets, but they're not always seeing what happens sort of behind the scenes. And I think one of the beautiful things about the organizations that are here is that they have earned the trust of the people. And so we are talking to elected officials and we are talking to major nonprofits in the city about what to do. But we do that and the people support us because we spent time in community and because we listen to everyday people, right? The people that we listen to and the people that we advise, not everybody has a college degree. Folks are from the neighborhoods and we have our ears sort of to the ground. So I think some of that structural stuff is happening. It's just not glitzy and glamorous. And so I like these folks and PJP included are doing some amazing research and work and having good conversations behind the scenes as well.
Ambrose Dupree, Be Quick, neither Be Quick nor Columbus Freedom Coalition are working with government officials yet. I know, and I certainly want Mia to talk about this too, but they're waiting for the mayor and the police chief to resign. What about your organization and how you see moving forward without working within the existing power structure?
It's very clear that it's the people that we want to work with. BeQuick is a community-led organization by and for Black LGBTQIA folks. Mm-hmm. And it's the people power that's going to make the change happen. And so we are investing our time in talking with people in the community, doing any sort of radical changes that we can do now with the people that it directly affects. The state and the city aren't going to help us, and it's been very clear from Mayor Ginther's a lot of gestures and then going back on his word that he's not for the people. And so we have to take care of the community. People are still going to exist. The community is still here. We have to take care of those folks.
And what does success look like to you in that case?
Well, we are an abolitionist. Okay. Organization. So we are trying to abolish those structures and those systems because, again, the people have the power. The people have the ability to keep each other safe, to govern each other, to do those accountability processes. But it's the state that's harming us, the city that's harming us. And if those systems are not here, if they're abolished, reform has not worked. It's the people who are going to make the decisions and the choices to keep each other safe and, you know, live a happy and prosperous life that we all deserve.
Mia Santiago, what about that issue of, you know, working within or without the existing power structure at the city level, I guess at the state level, too?
I think it can really sort of all go back to the Lord quote of the master's tools will never dismantle the master's house, in that this was a system that was not built for us. And so we don't think that policy reform is the way to get there. I mean, police were founded as slave patrols. I don't know how you can reform that into something that is not built to murder, oppress, hunt down Black people. And so I think that we are a community-based organization, and we are working with the community. And so we have no illusions of those in power willingly giving up power or making changes that maybe don't benefit them specifically, which is why it's important that all of the people who are at the state house find a place in our organizations. I mean, abolition is a far-reaching concept in that we are going to rebuild a lot of parts of society, and it's kind of a brick-by-brick process. So we need really community support more than we need any maybe like one figurehead in the city.
And success, I mean, this is, do you perceive this as a long-term proposition?
Absolutely. This is something that will take a long time because we are rebuilding a new kind of structure for community that keeps us safe. And, you know, that can't be done overnight.
You know, Jasmine Ayers, you said that the People's Justice Project does work within the, you know, works with existing power brokers, I guess, and power structure, the powers that be. How do you respond to what Ambrose and Mia have just said about how it isn't necessary and it is a long-term proposition?
Absolutely. So we view it as both and. So if somebody is not advising them, then they will get together and make up their own stuff. And what they have come up with so far on their own for the past however many years, right, has not clearly not worked. Mm-hmm. But in order to get to sort of longer term changes, there are things that they can do immediately. And we want to make sure that there is someone's voice in the room that is on the ground that has been doing this work. And so we also fundamentally believe that you have something that is built on the backs of slaves, right? Like you have a faulty foundation. And so what we're calling for is transformation, right? The entire system needs to be transformed. And so I think that everybody, we don't want to be in competition with everybody, right? Like everybody believes that Black Lives Matter. They know that the system is broken. They know that it needs to be reformed. And we know that we spend way too much money on police and that we're hiring people who, a lot of officers who fundamentally do not value the lives of Black people. And so I think that we can all agree on those things. Mm-hmm. How we get there and what that looks like is going to be different, but I'm absolutely proud to stand next to these folks. And I believe that we will get this done. But like I said, we want to make sure that they're not in back rooms by themselves having conversations about things that we know won't work.
And Ambrose Dupree, as far as you're concerned, I mean, do you feel the same way about the role of the People's Justice Project?
In that, could you clarify?
Well, that there's someone's in the room with them, that you guys can coexist and be beneficial to each other.
Absolutely. It's understanding, as Mia was saying, there's different, there's decentralized, there's different organizations doing different parts. And where BQIC's strength is the community and doing that sort of work, PJP can do and is doing that work to see that the city is reflecting what the people are saying. And so whole different path to the same point of abolition and freeing and liberating Black folks.
Ambrose Dupree, thanks for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Ambrose Dupree is core organizer of Black, Queer, and Intersectional Collective, known as Be Quick. Also, Jasmine Ayers, community organizer for People's Justice Project and a policy liaison for Policy Matters Ohio. Jasmine, thanks for your time.
Thank you so much.
We're going to continue our conversation with Mia Santiago, founding member of the Columbus Freedom Coalition, one of a number of local groups protesting police violence. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Social media enables protest organizers to amass thousands of participants in a matter of hours rather than months and sometimes years. That civil rights era organizers would have needed. The advantage of such speed is obvious, but the movement also lacks hierarchy and focus and political clout, and it's unclear who speaks for the protesters all the time and with whom some protesters will speak. Mia Santiago is a founding member of the Columbus Freedom Coalition. It's one of a number of protest groups demonstrating in Columbus right now, and the group wants to abolish the police department and prisons and has called for the resignations of the mayor of Columbus and the police chief here. Mia, thanks again for joining us today.
Of course, yeah, thanks.
Erica Crawley represents the 26th House District, which is composed of parts of East and Southeast Columbus and surrounding suburbs. She is a Democrat who is sponsoring legislation resulting from the demonstrations. Welcome to the show, Representative Crawley.
Hi, thank you for having me.
What is your sense about how to work with the different groups that are out there demonstrating every day since late May?
So I think it's important for especially elected officials who will be affecting change as far as legislation to have a direct relationship with those in the community, those who are organizing, to hear their voices, because at the end of the day, we work for the people. I work for the people. I serve at the will of the people. And so when I am at the State House advocating on behalf of change, it's not my voice that I bring, it's their voices. So in order to be able to lift up their message, I have to know what that is and be in community and conversation with them.
So what about groups that don't necessarily want to work within the existing structure of power as we know it today? How do you also represent them?
I think in order to change what the structure currently is, we have to be able to have a conversation about it. It's not going to be something that happens overnight. And we get to say what that change looked like, what the new system, what that reimagining is. But we can't do that if we are not talking with each other. Even when we disagree on different issues or how to move forward, that's fine too, and that will happen, but we have to continue to have the conversation.
Mia Santiago, what do you hear when you hear Representative Crawley talk? I mean, is that what the kind of listening and response that you're looking for?
I definitely think that's helpful. I would say, though, that that's kind of the purpose that our demands serve. The demands that I co-authored with Be Quick that kind of list what we're looking for as a community kind of cover those things. And so that's not necessarily the work that we as Columbus Freedom Coalition are focused on, kind of in like policy change or reform. Because we are an abolitionist organization and because we are tired of compromise, because it doesn't really get us anywhere, I think that we tend towards action that we feel is most effective and most lasting we can't wait is the issue. Abolition can't wait. I mean, with COVID right now running through prisons, it's a death sentence for so many people. Many of the hotspots for COVID in the United States are prisons, especially here in Ohio. And so while I appreciate the idea of being listened to by government, we need action like yesterday on this.
And Erica Crawley, from your experience in the Ohio General Assembly, what's your sense, particularly a General Assembly extremely dominated by Republicans, Republicans who represent largely rural, non-urban districts? What is your sense about how fast the Ohio General Assembly can move on any of this?
I think we could move fast if there was a political will to do so. And I think this is what you see, unfortunately, when you have a one-party rule. As the Ohio House is on recess right now, we don't come back until, I don't know, the end of September. The Senate is still meeting, and the Democrats have, we just had a press call yesterday, and we are demanding that we come back from recess, from vacations, because there is absolutely work that needs to be done that can't wait. But there is, it doesn't seem to be any expediency on the behalf of my Republican colleagues to do anything.
Right. I mean, I haven't seen any signal that they're coming back, but they are griping about damage to the State House. Mia Santiago, I'm just going to presume that that really doesn't bother you one way or the other.
Absolutely not. This country was built on the backs of Black people. It was built through slave labor, so we have every right to tear it down.
And
I don't know that that's necessarily the goal of the movement, but if anyone is concerned more about damage to a building than they are about the daily torture and murder of Black people at the hands of the police and the state, I don't really know how to be in community or work with them.
Hmm. Erica Crawley, what do you think about that?
Well, I think that there are people who are working to effectuate change. So I get that there might not be an interest to work with people who are only talking about buildings and not talking about the systemic oppression of Black people and people of color for over 400 years. I get that. But there are legislators like such as myself, the Ohio Legislative Black Caucus, who have been advocating for prison reform or release of prisoners for housing changes and health care, infant mortality, all of these things, law enforcement violence that goes to the public health crisis that we see today. And so there are elected officials who are working and open to having conversations with anyone who's willing to work with us. We can't do it alone. And so we need the support of organizations like the Columbus Freedom Coalition, Be Quick, and others to help us move this along. I am in the super minority. My colleagues in the Democratic Caucus are in the super minority. But we still are trying to work, do the work for the people.
Mia Santiago, Columbus Freedom Coalition formed last year after the death of teenager Julius Tate Jr., who was killed by Columbus police during an undercover investigation into a series of robberies. You use the word radicalized to describe your activism. Is the radicalized part this part that won't work with the existing institutions such as they are and then want the abolition of them, all things being equal?
It's just really kind of in the context of what's happening in this country. So while it should not be radical to think that we shouldn't have, you know, police officers walking around with guns, kind of shooting Black people anytime they claim they're threatened, that is a radical idea in some ways. And so I hope that someday my views are not radical and it's not really considered being radicalized to realize that this country was not built for us as Black people and that we need a massive overhaul of it. But yes, that is part of it. It's when I realized that the system was not going to accommodate me. There are not people who look like me or other members of Be Quick as Black, queer, and trans people in government for the most part. And so we have to work with our communities that do have our best interests at heart and that do agree with us on all points.
You know, Representative Crawley, just to look at the demonstrations and watch them and observe them is to see a huge difference in what they look like. There are everything from suburban families, all different colors of people from all different kinds of walks of life now. Does that change the dynamic for you where you sit in that super minority in the Ohio General Assembly?
It doesn't change the dynamics as much as I like to see a diverse group of individuals protesting. I think people are realizing that everything that we deal with in the Black community is inextricably linked to everyone else in every other community. So we should all be out protesting together about the injustices. But when it comes to what happens here in the State House, mm-hmm. I would like that to see, as I said a few weeks ago when I was out with Adrienne Hood and other mothers who have dealt with law enforcement violence or deaths of their children at the hands of cops, you know, I want to see that same energy and effort in the State House when these bills like Stand Your Ground that allows armed vigilantes to run throughout communities and kill people and not be held accountable are coming to the floor or in the hearing in committees for hearings. And there's not a outpouring of people coming to the State House to speak out against trash legislation like that. I want to see that same energy in the State House that we see outside. I would love nothing more to see everybody advocating inside like we are outside.
Hmm. Okay. And so I'm wondering what your sense is about whether or not they're going to open up the doors to the demonstrators when lawmakers return, I guess, in September or whenever.
The State House is the people's house.
Mm-hmm.
The Republicans do not own it.
But they've closed it before.
They have. That's unfortunate. At the end of the day, this is the people's house. It is open to the public. Which is why now when we have committees, every committee room has video cameras so it can be accessible to the public who can't make it down here to sit in the committee rooms and give testimony. We have to have full transparency. This is the people's house. They should be able to come in and have their voices heard in the committee rooms, on the chamber floors. And when they can't, that's when we do as legislators. And the Ohio Legislative Black Caucus, the Ohio Democratic Caucus, has been fighting for that, and we will continue to and work with whoever wants to work with us.
And Mia Santiago, I know you aren't going to meet with the mayor, with the police chief, the offices that they represent until Mayor Ginther and Chief Quinlan resign. What about the Ohio General Assembly? What about the Ohio State House going inside and talking with lawmakers?
It's hard to kind of figure out what our path would be on a hypothetical because mm-hmm. since we are a non-hierarchical group, that would be something that would be a group decision.
Yeah.
I will say, though, that the demands that we've endorsed include ending the felony murder rule. It includes ending qualified immunity. So it's not that we are not doing our research and that we don't know which laws are harmful for us, like Stand Your Ground. It's just, I think that, I mean, we all also have full-time jobs,
mm-hmm.
like separate from the organizing. And so we have to show up for our communities in the way that we can. I'm not personally sure how much good it would do to engage in the State House, given kind of all of the history that has ever happened in there. But I can't say as a group whether or not we would go in.
Well, Mia Santiago, thanks for your time today. I appreciate it.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
Mia Santiago is a founding member of the Columbus Freedom Coalition, one of a number of local groups protesting police violence down at the State House these days, which is where Erica Crawley works. She's a state representative for the 26th District, parts of East and Southeast Columbus. She's sponsoring some of the legislation resulting from the demonstrations. Representative Crawley, thanks for your time as well.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
And thanks to the All-Side staff, our producers, Aaron Esmont, producer Matthew Rand, our intern, Max Garrison, who produced this show, Atiyah Ture, Bobby Gerberic, with video production by Nick Payne. This is All-Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.